health is wealth. And this is where we're going to talk about it. The Small Conversations for a Better World podcast with hosts Jillian McCormick and Susanna Steers. This podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and or their guests to the show. The content is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice nor established legal standard of care. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Small Conversations for a Better World podcast. I'm Susanna Steers.
And I'm Jillian McCormick. Addressing chronic pain, chronic fatigue, or depression can be a long and winding road. There are options for treatment, including and not limited to medication, counseling, physiotherapy, massage therapy, movement and exercise protocols, meditation, acupuncture, sometimes exploratory surgeries, and other things. You get the picture. There are many ways to address these concerns, a laundry list of sorts. And the truth is that all of these avenues may offer a light in the path and the way back to health. An even deeper truth is that these complex diagnoses often require a more holistic approach to sort the optimal function of the body through all avenues possible. One such way is to consider which foods you eat. It's getting hard to decipher the best way to feed ourselves. Many of our doctors won't engage in a discussion of this beyond the words, follow the Canada Food Guide. Everywhere you Google these days, there are reports about different dietary changes and what impacts they have on our health. These reports suggest that all aspects of our health, from heart health, hormone health, brain health, with respect to dementia and mental health, with respect to mood, can be addressed through food. There are anti-aging diets that we say, that say we need to eat like cave people, that we need to eat mostly fat. Diets that say don't eat fat, eat carbs, only eat certain carbs, don't ever eat carbs, be vegetarian, be pescatarian, be an omnivore. Added to this confusion is that should you choose medical advice over Google, your entry into the system will determine the flavor of the advice you receive. Physicians might tell you something totally different than a registered dietitian. Naturopaths might tell you something different than a holistic nutritionist. And then there's your personal trainer. No matter who the advice comes from, these individuals likely mean very well. But the question that begs to be asked is, who is it best to listen to? And, you know, today we're not going to sugarcoat this topic and tell you that it's an easy road to navigate. We're not going to claim that we have all the answers to the questions surrounding this complex, multi-layered topic. But what we do hope to do today is shine some light on a unique program being offered through the Mood Disorders Association of BC that seeks to treat depression and possibly chronic pain through the use of dietary changes. The program is called Food as Medicine, and its co-founder is here on the pod to shed some light on the topic of what should I be eating anyway.
Dr. Leslie Wickless graduated from the University of Calgary Medical School in 1998 and completed her specialty training in psychiatry at UBC in 2003. She then practiced on the Provincial Child Inpatient Unit at the BC Children's Hospital until 2016, working intensively with children and families facing a wide range of psychiatric and medical challenges. In her role as clinical director, she introduced and piloted a new model of trauma-informed care, transforming the way psychiatric care is delivered to patients. Most recently, Dr. Wickless's interests have focused on the burgeoning field of nutritional psychiatry and the role of inflammation in both mood and pain disorders. She's currently training with the Institute of Functional Medicine, which uses a unique mechanism-based approach to identifying and treating the root causes of chronic disease. Dr. Wickless designed the Food as Medicine program to treat depressive mood disorders and fibromyalgia at the Mood Disorders Association of BC. She and naturopath Dr. Caroline Coombs first piloted this program in July 2016. Dr. Wickless has continued to deliver this service at MDA since then. Leslie, welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So maybe we could start with, what is nutritional psychiatry?
Okay, so nutritional psychiatry is the study of how diet, nutrition affects mental health, depression, other mood and brain-based disorders. And the coin or the term was coined by a psychologist, Dr. Felice Jacka, in Australia. And she and a number of different researchers in Australia have been publishing a lot of research and studies looking particularly at this topic. So that, I think, probably summarizes what nutritional psychiatry is all about.
I find it fascinating because it's not the typical image of a psychiatrist that would come immediately to mind for me. I've heard of professionals who engage in talk therapy programs and behavioral programs, and I've also heard many who seem to engage primarily in using pharmaceutical intervention to manage brain function. Can you maybe talk to us a little bit about how you ended up doing what you're doing now?
So I guess it starts with a personal story, which was I was working at the Children's Hospital, doing exactly what you're describing, conventional psychiatry, providing medications, doing therapy, all of the things that we psychiatrists are trained to do. And I developed something called complex regional pain syndrome, which is a neuroinflammatory disorder. It's an inflammatory disorder where you basically get pain in your body. So it started in my knee and it spread throughout my body. And I had really severe neuropathic pain, lots of swelling in my limbs to the point that I couldn't actually sit in a chair or bend my knee. My knee would swell so much with any kind of movement. I couldn't walk. And it was a very, very frightening experience, as you can imagine, because your whole world gets turned upside down. Everything you take for granted is gone. You know, you can't sit, you can't walk, you can't function. And so it took a while to figure out the diagnosis. But once we figured out the diagnosis, and I was able to access physicians trained in chronic pain, we went through a number of different treatments, medications, and nothing was really able to get me into remission. I had the experience that I know a lot of people can relate to, the experience of being told, well, there's nothing more we can do. You know, you're going to have to learn to live with this. And no one wants to hear that. Someone had told me about a book by Dr. Terry Walls, who is an internist, and she is trained in functional medicine. But she was an internist who developed MS, and I think she had a very similar experience based on, you know, what she describes in her book, where she went through all the conventional treatments for MS and reached the end of the line where there was nothing more to offer her. And at that point, she describes being in a anti-gravity wheelchair, unable to walk, in chronic pain, etc. And so she described her journey, which was going back to the basics. She had an inflammatory disorder. She had a neuroinflammatory disorder. And she went back to the basics, trying to figure out, how did I get this in the first place? What caused the inflammation? And so she devised a way of approaching this using functional medicine, where she used diet, nutrition, and some other interventions. And she actually was able to get into a full remission. So when I read that book, it just was very inspiring for me. And it made me think, okay, you know, I need to do the same thing. If she can recover, I need to figure out how I can recover too. So I went through the same process, going back to the literature, trying to figure out, learn everything I could about complex regional pain syndrome, what drives the inflammation, understanding the inflammation, and doing some training in functional medicine as well. And so, you know, I was able to gain some expertise in inflammatory disorders, and I really became interested in getting at the root cause, and diet is part of that root cause.
Wow. CRPS can, will clearly be very painful and totally debilitating in nature. And your experience sounds quite bad. I like to ask my patients what they think is going on, or if it is in the past, what they think happened to create the place they found themselves. If you feel comfortable, would you say more about what was happening when all of that started?
Sure. You know, some of this is going to be me looking back and making educated guesses, you know, so with hindsight. I've got my hypotheses, so I'll share them. So before I developed complex regional pain syndrome, I was definitely a type A kind of person, so quite driven. working hard. I trained hard, so I cycle a lot, and I did a lot of events and was training very hard on my bike. So I was driving myself pretty hard. And in retrospect, I can say like some of the things that were a clue that, that perhaps my health was not that good and I was developing neuroinflammation was I started having problems with sleep, so insomnia, you know, issues with brain fog, not concentrating as well as usual. So just, you know, some brain issues, I think. And then spontaneously, I developed this pain in my knee, which is very unusual for complex regional pain syndrome. And so, you know, when I sort of unpack what might have been going on from a functional medicine lens, I had some GI symptoms. So lots of loose stools that would suggest that, you know, perhaps I did not have the healthiest gut. And I think I probably had what we call increased intestinal permeability, which can happen with athletes who are training hard, which then can lead to systemic inflammation. So I think that played a component. And then it also turned out that I had mercury toxicity, which, you know, and we were looking for clues as to what could be causing this neuroinflammation. That was another thing. So I'm not very good at detoxifying and eliminating heavy metals. And I had very high levels of mercury just from eating sushi once or twice a week. So I think all of those factors played a role.
Yeah. And what do you think were the most important steps that you took to find your way back? Because it's a process when you find yourself that far down the road. Would you agree with that? It's a bit like one step at a time. And
Well, yes, for sure. So the recovery process was very slow. It occurred over, I'd say, 2 years. And so, I mean, the first thing was shutting down inflammation. So in my case, CRPS, if it's caught early, can be treated with prednisone. And so I was started on that, and that actually was sort of the first step in actually allowing me to do a little bit of rehab because it brought the inflammation down enough that I could bend my knee and walk. So I went from not being able to walk to being able to tolerate, you know, taking steps. But I couldn't tolerate prednisone long-term. I got really depressed on it, so I wasn't on it for very long. But it was enough to actually allow me to start rehabbing. And, you know, with chronic pain, there's that whole piece of actually just learning how much can you do, how can you pace yourself so you do just enough to get moving, to retrain your brain so that you're not afraid of the pain, but not so much that you flare so much pain that you can't recover the next day. Mm-hmm. So there was a process of working with a physiotherapist that was really important. There was a process of just learning to accept where I was, and, you know, not being anxious or panicking about the future, but this is where I am now and this is a process and I can recover. And then, you know, also looking at other interventions that can reduce inflammation as well. So it was a complicated process. So
is there a commonality to the underlying problem that might be present when people are diagnosed with CRPS or arthritis or fibromyalgia or depression? Is that inflammation?
I think that that's one of the underlying common features is inflammation. Absolutely. I think they're all a little bit different, but we know that in fibromyalgia, there's an inflammatory component and a neuroinflammatory component. In depression, I think there's, again, inflammation and neuroinflammation. So when I was actually learning about inflammation and the root causes of my condition, I learned a whole lot about fibromyalgia and also depression as well. So there's definitely some shared common features.
And can you explain inflammation a little bit for us?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is it?
So inflammation is a process. It's our body's way of protecting us. So if you have, for example, an injury or damaged cells, your immune system responds by creating an inflammatory response. So immune cells will come and they'll clean up the damage. If you have an infection, so say, you know, bacteria enters your bloodstream, again, it triggers the immune system. The immune system recognizes that they need to come in to clear the bacteria. So when there is, you know, either damaged cells or bacteria or toxins that are entering our bodies that should not be there, the immune system can recognize that and they create an inflammatory response. And I think we've all had that experience of, you know, when we have a flu or a cold, our immune system is responding and it's releasing these inflammatory mediators called cytokines. And when we have a quote, you know, cytokine storm or a lot of cytokines, we feel it. So, you know, you're very fatigued. You can't think very well. You're just in bed. There's no motivation. There's no time. You feel terrible. That's your immune system. But what should happen is the immune system should on its own be able to deal with whatever the, you know, threat is and then resolve itself. And so you go back to your normal homeostasis, and that may not be happening with people with chronic inflammation. So they have maybe this chronic low-grade inflammation where they may be feeling tired and have brain fog and motivation's low, and there's this low-grade inflammation, but it's not resolving. It's still there.
And in this context, is the when we're talking about a low-grade inflammation, would it be throughout the whole body, systemic, in an organ, in the brain? Where would it? Is there a locus for the inflammation?
It's a really good question, and I think it can be any of the above, and it may be different for different diseases. Mm-hmm. So what we know about depression is that if not, and not everybody has increased inflammatory markers if we try to measure them, but if you try to measure inflammatory markers with some people with depression, you'll see that there's a correlation. Higher inflammatory markers may correlate with a poorer response to treatment, that these people tend to have maybe more difficult depression to treat. They don't respond as well to medications. And then you see that when they do respond and they're getting better, that some of these inflammatory markers come down. So there's a correlation. I don't know that we can say exactly how it works. I'm not sure that we know that.
Is inflammation as a phenomenon proven in the evidence, or is it simply at this point a working hypothesis of illness?
I think there's a pretty clear link that inflammation is linked to a number of diseases, and that when you reduce inflammation, you can see improvements in these disease states. So I think there's definitely a link. And because, you know, when inflammation is the activation of the immune system, I think when you have the immune system working, there's probably damage to organs and cells. And, you know, and that's part of the issue that happens when you have this chronic unchecked inflammation. So it's definitely been substantiated as a link to a number of disease states.
So earlier you were saying, Leslie, just describing some of the conditions, and you were saying there's components of inflammation and neural inflammation. And could you just give us a little, like, are those two different things in your mind?
Well, neuroinflammation just means that there's inflammation in the brain. And then there's systemic inflammation, which means it's in the body, not necessarily in the brain.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair.
And is it only poor food choices when we're talking about food and how we're dealing with food or using food to treat the body and reduce inflammation? Is it the poor food choices that we make, or is it related to the use of chemicals to enhance mass production of food when we ingest it? Are those components in the problems of inflammation and food?
Well, I guess the first thing I should say is there's lots of causes of inflammation, so it's not just food. So wide variety and range of things that can trigger inflammation. And then when we look at where does the inflammation come from, like, so why do people have inflammation, and we look specifically at diet, there's, again, patterns. So what we know is that certain dietary patterns are more likely to lead to inflammation. So foods that are very high in sugar, that have trans fats, foods like fast foods, lots of saturated fats, processed meats, things that are deep fried, these are things that tend to be associated with higher levels of inflammation. And then, you know, there's lots of different theories about the mechanisms about why these foods can lead to inflammation. But it's, again, you know, sort of a variety of different foods and dietary patterns that are linked to inflammation. So what we call a Western diet, which is what a lot of us eat, which is processed foods, fast foods, deep fried foods, these are linked to higher rates of inflammation. Whereas anti-inflammatory diets like the Mediterranean diet, if you were to measure inflammatory markers in people that are following a Mediterranean diet, they have much lower levels of inflammation.
Right.
Leslie, what is the link between gut function, depression, and serotonin?
Okay. Well, that's another one that's a little bit complicated, but there is one for sure. And one that I think probably most of the research right now is looking at the link between the microbiome and depression. And diet, I think, is linked to the microbiome. So you can't really talk about the microbiome without talking about diet. But,
and why is that?
What's that?
Why, how are they linked?
Because what we eat, has an impact on our microbiome. So for example, so I'm assuming that people know what the microbiome is, but I'll just kind of back up and explain. So these are the bacteria that reside in our intestines. And we have a lot of them, and they serve a lot of different functions. And what we're learning is that the health of the microbiota or biota may actually have an impact on all disease states, including brain diseases and depression. And so, for example, we've seen that in animal studies where they do fecal transplants, you can actually transfer depression. So I'll just give you an example of one study where human beings that had depression. There was a study where we took, I didn't take them, but the researchers took the feces from these human beings and transplanted them into rats. And then they took human beings that didn't have depression, and they also transplanted their feces into another set of rats. And the rats that got the feces from the depressed human beings started to demonstrate symptoms of depression. And they also had a tendency towards increased inflammatory markers. So there's something about the microbiome, what's growing in our intestines, that can actually affect whether we develop depression or not. And as I mentioned, lots of different theories about why that works. One is that the microbiota can control inflammation. So certain populations of the microbiota, a healthier microbiota, tends to result in less inflammation. They have an impact on neurotransmitter productions, which have an impact on brain functions. They have an impact on creating vitamins for our body. So they do a lot of different things.
Right. Okay. So microbiome.
Things like with the nervous system and the vagus nerve. So, yeah. So it's very important. And so given that we know that a healthy microbiota is really important for all aspects of health, then the question is, like, how do you have it? What do you do to maintain a healthy microbiota? And that's, I think, where diet comes in.
Okay. So the different choices you could make in terms of diet will feed or kill off various aspects of your microbiota.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the direction that the research is pointing. And in terms of killing off, I'm not so sure about that. That may be true, but I'm not sure about that. I think what we do know is that diets that are really rich in fiber and plant-based foods encourage the growth of certain species that can have an impact on our health and depression and anxiety in humans. So a really fiber-rich diet is quite good for the microbiota. So these are feeding the bacteria with prebiotics, is what we call it. So prebiotics meaning it's the food for the bacteria, whereas probiotics is when we actually ingest the bacteria ourselves, when we have fermented foods that's full of bacteria, or if we take a probiotic pill.
Is that something that is better to get in the food you eat as opposed to a pill? You know, I hear about a lot of people taking prebiotics and probiotics. Do you have an opinion on whether it's better to eat it or whether it's better to get it in a pill?
I think it's always good to get your nutrition from food, but there is a role for pills as well. So fermented food is a fantastic way of introducing healthy bacteria or different variety of bacteria into your gut. And then there are different prebiotics that can potentially be helpful for mood, depression, and other disorders as well. If you're going to pick a prebiotic, you want to specifically make sure that the strains that you pick have some evidence for working for whatever disorder you're trying to treat.
What I heard is that it's actually really difficult to change your microbiotic environment. I heard it was hard to do that. I listened to various podcasts and things, so I couldn't tell you where I heard that from, but there was this like, actually, we've proven that the microbiome is really quite hardy. And have you heard that? And do you agree with that?
I have heard it. I am not a researcher. So I haven't specifically researched it. I have seen that there are studies that show that when you change the diet, you can see changes in the microbiota in the stool. The question is, how long will it last? And I don't have the answer to that. Do we revert back to our old microbiota? Maybe. So I don't think I'm probably the best person to answer that question in terms of long-term changes to the microbiota from diet. But I do think that when you feed your cell sort of lots of these anti-inflammatory foods and fiber, there can be short-term changes for sure in the microbiota.
So your program, Food is Medicine, mm-hmm. how did it get started?
So it's started initially with a pilot program that I joined Caroline Coombs actually at Change Pain. So she was doing a program where she was using dietary intervention to treat pain. And I ended up going to Change Pain and joining her, and we created something there that was a little bit different. And as we were treating people there with dietary interventions, making dietary recommendations, we were noticing actually at about the 3-week mark that a lot of them were reporting improvements to their mood. So decreased depression, improved energy. And this was preceding any really significant changes to pain. So I was actually very interested at that point in using this intervention, creating an intervention that could be used with people with depression, not necessarily with pain, but just treating depression to see what would happen. There certainly was a lot of research in the literature to support using an anti-inflammatory diet with depression, in that people that follow anti-inflammatory diets like the Mediterranean diet tend to have a much lower risk of depression. And I think we all know that, you know, a lot of people who seek treatment for depression, they do get response from antidepressants and therapy, but they don't necessarily get a full response. So they may get better, but not fully better. And some people don't get better at all. So, you know, I was very interested in what else is there that we can offer patients with depression that could be helpful to them. And so that's basically how this got started.
That's great. It's sort of a happy accident.
Yeah, right.
So is a mood disorder like depression often associated with chronic pain?
I'd say it's the other way around. Most people with chronic pain have depression, but not most people with depression have pain.
Right. Yeah, I guess if you've got chronic pain that you have to deal with every day and it's created some losses in your life, you're likely to feel depressed.
Yeah,
it could go the other way too. If you're feeling like you can't move well, as you mentioned earlier in your story, that you couldn't do the things that you were used to doing, and that made you depressed and unhappy too.
Mm-hmm. Although I will say this, that was very interesting. This was a lesson for me, is I thought that way. I thought if only my pain could get better and I could walk again, I wouldn't feel depressed. And when I was in that rehab process, my pain did get better and I was able to walk. I was even able to get back on my bike, but I was still depressed. So I don't think it's always psychological. I do think that there's a change in your physiology, and I had to specifically treat the depression to fully be able to get better from the pain.
And would you say that you did that with food, or was specifically treating depression?
Medication and therapy.
Thank you for saying that. That's, I think, a really important point. I see people in my office all the time with different kind of pain scenarios, and chronic pain certainly is one of them. And I'm always talking to them about how, like, they have to address a lot of things. You have to treat the whole person. And that might be related to their thoughts and their feelings, definitely.
Yeah.
A
I think it's, you know, it's a hard one to tease apart, because when you're in a depressed state, you have a lot of depressed thoughts and anxious thoughts, and you get hyper-focused on your pain.
Yeah.
And, you know, people would say, well, if I didn't have the pain, I wouldn't hyper-focus. But I don't know that, you know, where's the chicken and the egg here? I'm not sure.
Yes. Great question. And I feel like I actually need to go back for just one second here. We were talking about how the microbiome is important in protecting us or resolving inflammation. And is that the link to depression?
No, I really don't think it's simplistic like that. I think yeah. there's multiple factors, and I don't think we fully understand it.
Okay.
So this is the way I understand it is, so we've got this body of evidence that shows that when people follow, say a Mediterranean diet, there's lower, markers of inflammation. There's, reduced risk for inflammatory disorders, including depression. So we've got a whole bunch of studies supporting that. Okay. And then, you know, we've got some studies that have come out showing that for people that have depression, if you switch them from, a Western style diet, inflammatory diet, to an anti-inflammatory diet, we can actually see improvements in their depression. And so we know that diet can have an impact. And then the question is, why does diet have an impact? And that's really where the research is at right now, trying to figure that out. And, you know, I think there's a lot of different ways that diet could be having an impact. The microbiome is one. This concept of intestinal permeability is another. The specific nutrients that are associated with the diet is another way that it can have an impact. So, you know, I think there's lots of different mechanisms, and it hasn't fully been elucidated in terms of what plays a role, you know, with what in terms of completely understanding this.
And I think what came into my mind as you spoke about it is that the challenge for a lot of people that are just out in the world with whatever they are suffering from, thinking, how do I get better, when they do a Google, is that Google tends to be super reductionist.
Mm-hmm.
Wants the one magic bullet, when really, just as you said, there's so many multiple layers when it comes to human physiology that there may be a way to impact a condition or a way that you feel or something that's happening, a process in your body.
Yeah.
A lot of which we don't even understand at this point necessarily. So it can't be reduced is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be reduced.
Yeah. Yes, I agree with that.
How do patients access your program?
So they get referred by their family doctors or another physician, and they need to have a diagnosis of a depressive disorder or fibromyalgia. So that's basically how to access the program.
Got it. I would think that there would be a lot of people out there who would be interested in trying to treat their depression or fibro with changes in diet rather than pharmaceuticals or some of the other, or in conjunction. Fair enough. But often one of the goals is I might reduce how much medication I'm taking by doing these other things.
Yeah, the majority of the people that I see are on medications and they've only had a partial response. Or sometimes they haven't had much of a response at all. And about in the individuals that come with a mood disorder, with depression, I'd say about 50% of them notice some significant improvements at the end of the 8 weeks. You know, I definitely see some people that their depression gets better and they no longer have depression after, say, 3 months or a little bit longer with dietary changes, and that's the only change they make. But then there's also people that, you know, may see small changes, improvements that improves their function, but they still have depression. And then there's always some people that it doesn't make any difference at all. So I think it's the same with any intervention. You know, and I think the one thing that I really stress in the group is that it's not just enough to change the diet. So the diet is the foundation. So, you know, I kind of think about this as, in order for your cells to function properly, you really need to have the building blocks. So if you're not providing, you know, the appropriate nutrients, if you have this pro-inflammatory state that may be coming from your diet, you need to address that first so that your body has the opportunity to heal. But there's other things as well. So when we're in a state of stress, So stress has been associated with inflammation. So if we're not feeling safe and we're in that fight or flight state, there's like significant stressors that haven't been resolved, I think it's very difficult to heal, because that drives an inflammatory component. It keeps the nervous system hyper aroused. So that's one thing. If you're not sleeping well, you know, that's another thing that needs to be addressed. And sometimes also there's other comorbid inflammatory disorders like uncontrolled diabetes or untreated sleep apnea or inflammatory bowel disease. And all of these things need to be addressed as well. So again, it's looking at the whole picture. And functional medicine tends to take a systems-based approach. So, you know, they're looking at diet, they're looking at gut health, at hormones, toxic burdens, the health of the mitochondria. So there's all of these different things that you look at in trying to sort out what could be affecting a person's health.
Can we talk for a couple of minutes and about this food specifically, about the diet specifically, and what are some of the most common food-related interventions that you give and why you might give them? So, you know, there are a few that are sort of front and center in the news these days, gluten or sugar or dairy. Could you talk a little bit about why you might discuss those particular things with people and how they might change how they eat or what they eat?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is that, again, it's a dietary pattern. So I think it is important to look at specific things, but more important than that is the overall diet. And so a diet that's really heavy in sugar, where there's a lot of added sugar, ends up being pro-inflammatory. So the first thing is getting rid of the added sugar. So that's pretty important. And sugar is important for a number of different reasons. But when we have what we call high glycemic sugar foods in our diet, so like, you know, think about just refined sugar in cakes, pastries, desserts, you end up getting a spike in your blood sugar and then a drop. And when that blood sugar drops, people feel like they need more sugar to boost their energy. So they'll often be on what we call the sugar roller coaster. So you have the sugar, you get maybe, this boost in energy, then it drops and then you're really tired, say 1 to 2 hours afterwards, and then you're reaching for more sugar. So that's one of the first interventions, is learning how to pick what we call lower glycemic index foods. So where the sugars more release more slowly into the bloodstream, so you can keep your blood sugar stable. And that seems to make a big difference for people's energy and brain function. You know, they feel like they're functioning a bit better there when they keep their blood sugar stable. So that's one. And then the other thing would be really increasing plant-based foods. So having lots of nutrient-dense foods and plants that haven't been processed. So we don't necessarily want the wheat processed into a grain or a cereal, like a cereal grain. We want the whole grain. So things that haven't been processed. And when it's a whole grain and it hasn't been processed, there's more fiber. So that slows the absorption of the sugar. So lots of nutrient-dense foods, lots of vegetables, real food, not processed food, not fast food. So I think that's kind of the key. And then healthy oils. And then we can look at down the road, could there be a food sensitivity? So could a person be sensitive to something like dairy or gluten? And the only way to really know that is to eliminate those foods from the diet and see whether when they're out of the system for 3 weeks, if someone's symptoms improve.
Right. And how do people do? I mean, I've certainly tried a whole bunch of ways to change how I eat, and it's not at all easy. I would imagine that if people see improvement in how they're feeling, that would drive the habit to change home. But do you have any data on how well people do or how well they stick to this kind of program?
We haven't monitored the data. So in the 8 weeks that they're in the Food as Medicine program, they stick to it pretty well. I continue to follow people over a period of 6 months. So some people will come back and, you know, and they've had some lapses and they've fallen back to old patterns. Others don't. It's really individual specific, I think. Some people have really, I think, significant sugar cravings and sugar addictions, you know, or they use food to deal with stress. And so in those situations, I think it's really important to come up with all other ways of managing stress and finding other foods, you know, that you can enjoy without having to reach for the sugar.
Right.
And that's going to be helpful long term. But I agree, when they're in a group environment and they start experiencing that they feel better and they share it with the group, other people are motivated. It's like, oh, wow, you know, this person's feeling better by changing their diet, and I'm motivated. I want to feel that way too. So I think the group environment can actually be very therapeutic in supporting people to make these changes and sticking with them. But it's hard. It's hard changing habits.
Change is always hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've heard of practitioners that recommend getting sensitivity testing in advance of doing an elimination diet. Do you find that is that useful?
I don't think that there is a lot of evidence to support it. There's a lot of debate about whether or not it's a reliable test. So that's not what I recommend. We usually just suggest do an elimination diet and see how your body feels.
Okay. So do you think people can do this at home by themselves?
To change their diet?
Yeah, just on their own, just jump in and go for it?
Sure.
How would you recommend they start? Do they do the Dr. Google, or are there sources where they can look for good information?
So you can look up Mediterranean diet. You can look up anti-inflammatory diets, which would give you an idea. You know, it doesn't have to be a Mediterranean diet. An anti-inflammatory diet can be consistent with any cultural cuisine. So really all it is real food, like real food, lots of plant-based foods. So the first thing is just getting rid of the sugars and the baked goods. Like that would be the first thing that you do, is get rid of some of these really sweet foods, you know, the pops, even fruit juice has a lot of sugar in it. So you might have a piece of fruit instead, or put the fruit in a blender and make a smoothie. That's the first step. And then the next thing is just really increasing the amount of vegetables you take in, lots of vegetables and whole grains. So things like, instead of having processed cereal, you could have oats, not the instant oats, but you know, the thicker oats, and you can make an oatmeal because that's got a lot of fiber and that's going to keep your blood sugar a lot more stable than, say, a bowl of cornflakes, which is going to spike your blood sugar. So whole grain rice or quinoas or beans are good options in terms of getting fiber in and keeping blood sugars a bit more stable versus ordering a pizza sandwich or pasta. And there are good alternatives for pasta as well. So you can still make these changes. For example, there are protein-based pastas now that are out there that are higher in protein and have very little carbs. Or some people will take spaghetti squash and bake that, and you can use that as a noodle or a squash, or even instead of using pasta, you can put your sauce on some rice or quinoa. So there's ways of still enjoying your foods, but just kind of shifting away from some of these processed grains.
So it sounds like we're taking it one step at a time and doing some trial and error, aren't we?
Yeah, and really just introducing more foods. I think what a lot of people do is they just get stuck in, you know, their habit of they have the cereal for breakfast and then their sandwich for lunch and their pasta or burger or whatever for dinner.
Yeah.
So
is there anybody who shouldn't be doing this? I mean, I guess anyone that doing this kind of, I don't know, maybe it's intentional planning around it or this kind of diet. Is there anybody for whom it might not be safe? I'm thinking sort of specifically about different kinds of eating disorders and even orthorexia, which I understand to be clean eating and clean living taken to the extreme. Is somebody like that, should they be diving into something like this?
Should they be? Well, I guess what's the alternative? Like, is it better for them to eat the fast foods and the inflammatory foods?
I guess that's true. Yes.
It's not all or nothing though. And I think that's kind of what you're getting to at.
Yes.
You know, it's like, okay, so let's say the majority, you have a lot more whole grains and you have a lot of vegetables. Are you going to beat yourself up because you had a bowl of cereal or you had a piece of cake when you go out with your friends? No. You know, if 80% of the time you're eating well and 20% of the time you indulge in some foods that may not be optimal for your health, I don't think that matters. It's really, again, the overall pattern. I follow an anti-inflammatory diet, but I'm not restrictive. So if I'm out with friends and we're out for dinner, I'll order a dessert. Or, you know, eat things that maybe I wouldn't necessarily have at home. So there's always room for indulging. And it's not going to cause harm to have some of these treats some of the time.
I love that.
It's fine.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah. I love that. There's an air of extremism out in the world sometimes, and the 80-20 rule, that definitely resonates for me.
No kidding.
I have a specific question about an elimination diet. How long must you eliminate something to be considered able to judge if there's an impact?
So the minimum would be 3 weeks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the minimum of 3 weeks, and sometimes a little bit longer, but most people will notice something within 3 weeks if they have a food sensitivity.
So clinically, you must see changes for the better because you keep doing this kind of work. But can you tell us how successful it is for people? And do you have any stories of success that you could share with us? Aside from yours?
Yeah. So definitely, when it works, it's pretty amazing. And I've seen a number of people with depression, you know, just changing the diet is what it takes to get them to be functional again. There was one young woman who really didn't want to be on medications, and this is not my typical, participant. Usually most people come in are on medications, but she didn't want to be on a medication. And she was eating a kind of standard diet, but tended to skip meals a lot. So she wasn't really keeping her blood sugars very stable. Over the course of the 8 weeks, just really paying attention to getting lots of vegetables and nutrient-dense foods and eating regularly and making sure that she was eating enough to keep her blood sugar stable so that her brain had the fuel that it needed to function better, she was actually able to recover completely from her depression. And I saw her again in follow-up, and she still didn't have any signs of depression. So, you know, that was sort of an extraordinary case where it was just changing the diet. That was the only intervention. And then, you know, I've had people that have osteoarthritis and depression who, when they shift to an anti-inflammatory diet, a lot of the pain gets better. So there was one older woman who came through the group, and she noticed that it was sugar. When she had a lot of sugar in her diet, her pain flared. And it was when she made those shifts to having no sugar in her diet and a lot more vegetables and, healthy fats that her pain pretty much got better and she was functional. So she completed the group feeling pretty good and then had, I guess, what we'd call a sugar relapse. And then came back again because, you know, she'd been under stress and kind of fell back into her old eating patterns. And then repeated the group again and again got a very similar result. So, yeah, so I've definitely seen people with significant improvements in pain and in mood through making dietary changes.
And what about you, Leslie? Are you fully recovered?
I am. Yep, I'm fully recovered. And I don't want to say that it was due to diet because diet was a component, but definitely I don't think that diet is adequate to treat CRPS or fibromyalgia. I mean, I've been surprised that diet seems to work for some people with depression and is adequate.
Pleasantly surprised, I imagine.
Surprised, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and I can just mention that I think that's where most of the research is when we're looking at diet. There's three trials now that have looked at diet as a treatment for depression. And, you know, there's diet as a treatment for cardiovascular disease and high blood pressure. And so there are other diseases, diabetes, that can respond to diet. We don't have any control trials looking at diet for pain disorders or fibromyalgia. Mm-hmm. So we're not there yet. But, you know, but there's lots of reasons to believe that diet can make a difference. And I've certainly seen it make a difference. And again, it's because inflammation is linked to these disorders. So if you can modulate inflammation, I think you can see an impact.
Okay, Doc, I'm in. I believe you. Why is this not a universal approach to treating illness?
Well, I mean, I guess I think diet should be like one of the first things that we talk to people about. It may not be adequate in and of itself, but it's a really good first start. And if some people can recover by just diet alone and don't have to move on to medications, why not, right? I guess it's partly because, at least when in psychiatry, that's not part of the training yet. So a lot of the research, when I mentioned there have been three trials, they've only been from 2017 on. Right. So this is very new.
Wow, it's new.
Yeah. So, you know, we've got this has not made it yet into mainstream psychiatry. And there probably need a lot more trials for doctors to start using it as their treatment intervention. There's a lot more evidence supporting the use of medications.
Right. And as you say, if the training isn't there initially, that's not going to be what they have in their toolbox to pull out, you know, that's not going to be the first thing they pull out in terms of treatment.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I never would have known about this had I not developed an inflammatory condition myself and started doing research on it. It definitely was not on my radar. I didn't know it existed. If anyone said you could treat depression with diet, I probably would have said, I don't think so.
Oh, fascinating. Okay, I do think it's worthwhile taking a detour here for the benefit of all of us understanding the picture, in Canada at least. And definitely, Leslie, please jump in here if you think that I'm not going in the right direction or don't have this right. My understanding is Canadian doctors are publicly funded and that funding is earmarked specifically for treatment and not prevention or wellness. So diet and wellness conversations aren't funded well. Is maybe one piece of not talking about food. And then another thing is that I understand doctors cannot prescribe a placebo. That's literally against the law. It has to have a different kind of evidence than simply placebo impacts.
That's right. Yeah. That would not be ethical to prescribe placebo.
It's not ethical to prescribe a placebo. Okay. Mm-hmm. So then looking for that particular kind of evidence, a double-blinded, randomized, controlled clinical trial would be the gold standard here.
That's right, yeah.
Food-based interventions are pretty tough to do with that randomized controlled trial. Yeah. Like a pharmaceutical study, I mean, you guys can picture it out there in the world who are listening. There's one pill that's the actual drug and one that's a pill with sugar in it, and they look exactly the same. So that person who is taking a medication versus not a medication, you know, wouldn't know, but if it's food, you're preparing the food. You bought the food. The food's in front of you and you have to eat it. So you clearly know what you're doing. You are, as a study participant, inherently biased, I suppose, is part of the challenge.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, I can't say 100% that the people who responded responded just because it was the diet. You know, could it have been a placebo response? Possibly.
Right.
Because I don't have a control group. But as I mentioned, there have been three studies where there have been control groups. And probably the best one was done by Felice Jacka in 2017, where she took individuals that had clinically diagnosed depression, and they were randomized to either receive a modified Mediterranean diet or a sort of a social support group treatment. So the individuals knew what they were getting. So they weren't blind to the treatment. But the individuals that got the dietary intervention had a much more robust response to the treatment. So both groups were expecting to get some benefit, but the dietary treatment was superior with, I think it was like one third of the individuals going into remission Oh, wow. Okay. But you're right, though. It's not the gold standard double blind. And I've only seen one study in psychiatry that was like that, where they took individuals with schizophrenia. I believe it was schizophrenia. And they put them in hospital. So everyone got the exact same diet, right? It was controlled, because most of these studies, they get the dietary advice, but then they're doing it on their own. So you don't know exactly what they're eating. So in this particular study, they were put in hospital, and the study was specifically looking at whether a gluten-free diet could benefit this population. And so in the smoothies, half of the group got gluten and they didn't know it. And the other half didn't. They all thought they were getting a gluten-free diet. And in this particular study, there were some improvements in negative symptoms of schizophrenia in the individuals that had the gluten-free smoothie. But that was a really controlled dietary intervention. And that's really hard to do, like, you know, getting everyone eating the exact same food in a controlled setting and not knowing what's different.
And to agree to live in a hospital and only eat the things that are provided for them at particular times. I mean, that's quite a thing. Yeah. And to get like a big enough sample size to, again, have the numbers that you need for quote unquote proof or evidence.
Yeah. But, you know, I guess my thought is we've got a lot of data suggesting that inflammation is connected to depression and other diseases. So, you know, that's pretty clear. There's evidence linking the two. And we see that, I see all the time, people with depression and chronic pain syndromes, they often don't respond to medication. So what else are we going to offer? Do we just say, sorry, you know, like, you can just have to learn to live with it? Because no one wants to hear that. You want to be able to have something else that they can potentially do to get them better. And that's where I think looking at diet and other lifestyle interventions that can reduce inflammation is a reasonable approach to this.
Agreed. Absolutely.
Dr. Wickliss, we want to thank you from the bottom of our hearts for coming on the show to shed some light on how to change your mood disorders, your depression, and maybe even your chronic pain by changing what you eat. We are grateful to know that there are people like you representing this space where science and wellness meet. But before we go, we ask everybody that comes on the show this final question. Can you tell us, what is health?
Okay. So I don't know that I have the answer to that, but health is connected to vitality and the ability to live your life, you know, with energy, with your brain functioning well, to be able to get joy from life. And, you know, when I see people, I'm taking this from the people that I often work with who have depression and they lose their joy, you know, they don't have the energy to do the things they want. Their brain doesn't function very well. It's very similar with people with chronic pain. Regaining health is being able to regain the ability to feel vital and live your life. It doesn't mean that everything's perfect or that your cells are functioning perfectly, but to know that you can actually live with vitality, to me, is kind of what health is about.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and really giving us some good information of things we can play with and places we can look for support, even just at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's all for today's small conversation. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. We'll provide links to Dr. Wickliss and the Mood Disorders Association of BC in the show notes so you can learn more about the other fascinating things they do there. And we'll be here next time.
And we'll have the coffee on.
If you liked what you heard, we encourage you to head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. Better yet, subscribe and leave a review. That really helps to make it easier for others to find us to help broaden this small conversation.